Better put on the headphones, huh? Okay, hi. We're on program number 7 on the Rays and the Initiations Part 2 webinar commentary, and we're facing this wonderful old catechism, which I'm going to read through straight. And then make some comment upon. So the master is speaking, or the Hierophant, and the Chela is responding. And dost thou see the door, O Chela, in the light? I see the door and hear a calling voice. What should I do, O master of my life? Go through that door, and waste not time in backward glances at the road just trodden. Go forward into light. The door is far too narrow, O master of my life. I fear I cannot pass. Go closer to the door, and take the hand in thine of another pilgrim on the way of life. Go closer to the door. Seek not to enter it alone. I cannot see the door now that I grasp the hand of a brother on the right and a brother on the left. I seem surrounded by the pilgrims on the way. Alike they seem, their note is one. They seem like unto me and press around on every side. I cannot see the door. Move forward on the path, O pilgrim in the light, and stand together, hand in hand, before the door of light. What seest thou? The door again appears, and wide it seems, not narrow as before. What was that I saw before? It was not like the door which now confronts this band of brothers as we stand together on the path. The door you saw before was a figment of your mind, a thought form of your separative creation, something that cuts you off from truth, too narrow for your passing, yet full of wrong allure. Only the man who holds his brother's hand can see the door in truth. Only the man surrounded by the many who are the one can enter the door which shuts itself upon the man who seeks to enter it alone. Marvelous, marvelous, marvelous. So we're going to take a look at this and see perhaps some of the indicated meanings, but of course I think you can understand these meanings, and I'll just maybe say a few things. So this is a catechism concerning initiation. And the guide, or the Hierophant, or the one who knows the process, is asking the questions and giving the advice. And dost thou see the door, O Chela, in the light? And we wonder whether this is a specific category of Chelaship. There is that, you know, little Chela, but the is the first, and the second is Chela in the light. Of course, this might apply to those taking a number of initiations, but by the time one has taken the second initiation, one knows what the master says here to be the truth. So maybe this is the Chela in the light in a technical sense, that is, following the first initiation, but one who has not yet taken the second, and one who is not yet an accepted discipleship, a disciple. I see the door and hear a calling voice. The calling voice, the voice of the Hierophant, the voice of one's own soul. What should I do, O master of my life? Because, and of course this elicits the proper response and the proper advice, because catechisms are not just for the Catholic Church, right? They are meant to teach something. Go through that door and waste not time in backward glances at the road just trodden. There is the tendency, you know, to always look back over what we have done and not face in the fullest possible way the future. Master Moria tells us we should be racing forward like a man on horseback crossing a burning bridge, burning behind him, and if he does not hasten to the other side, it will collapse upon him. That's the forward-looking view of the first ray with its idea, main theme of progress onward, or driving forward into space, as it is called. So go forward into light, and behind the door of initiation, always a greater light will be found, you know, and in that light we shall see light. So there will be an increase of light over that which we now experience when we stand before the door. But it turns out that this door may be, after all, an imagined door. The idea is that there is a forward progression, and too much viewing of one's previous path, of course, some of it is maybe necessary because it shows us where we have made mistakes and where we have succeeded, and it may teach us something. But if we, I'm sorry, but if we ponder upon that excessively, it not only increases the ahamkara, it gives us a sense of being the isolated individual, which we are not. It leads backward into the personality, but we do not use the time properly because there is not a moment to lose. There is no time to waste, you know, and yet there is no time to lose. So both Master DK and Master M tell us to hasten forward. But, oh, what happens? The door is far too narrow. You know, the straight and narrow path. The man conceives of himself as not fit to pass through the door. It's the straight and narrow path. I fear I cannot pass. The requirements look too high, and there's no way for me to, you know, this is the anticipation of the passing through the eye of the needle. It's only after the anticipation of it. It's not yet that. It's only after we have collapsed time and space in our consciousness that we can actually pass the needle's eye. And this is some anticipation of that later process, which will occur as we approach the fourth degree. Anyway, this is not a passable door. Well, then the master advises, go closer to the door, and here's the key. Take the hand of thine brother, take the hand in thine of another pilgrim on the way of life. Go closer to the door and seek not to enter it alone. This is all about group initiation. And what it does is it makes the door passable. You would think, you know, if the door was what it seemed to be at first, that taking the hand of another, either on the right or the left, would make the door totally impassable. But it is the power of love which widens the door immensely. And initiation has always been a group process, DK tells us. And when we take the hand of another, take the hand in thine of another pilgrim on the way of life, a pilgrim is a, you know, a monad in extension going through this entire process, and we are on the way of life, the way of the Antikarana, the way that leads back to the monadic plane and to the source of life, which is the interior of the monad. And when we do that, we express our unity with the one soul, and our unity, our identicality with the one being. And it's, in a way, equivalent to collapsing time and space. So do not seek some individual ahamkaric, isolated, lonely passage through the door as if it was an egoistic event. It's not an egoistic event. It has to do with the stimulation of the heart and the realization of a group consciousness and group being. So although it's somewhat paradoxical when we think of it simply in imagined terms, because, you know, we become a very broad thing when we take the hand of another, it somehow dissolves the barrier. It widens the door and dissolves the barrier. And suddenly, okay, I cannot see the door because I'm not even concerned now about the path of initiation. I'm concerned about the welfare of my brother. So, you know, the very, the second rule, let me see if I can turn to that. The second rule, and I'll go in initiation human, no, that's not it. In initiation human and solar. There we go. Okay. I'll go to about page 20 in the Reyes Initiation because those rules are included. And here we go. When application has been made in triple form, let the disciple withdraw that application and forget it has been made. Well, basically what's happening here, even in the first of the rules, we find that our the fire is burning bright in our heart to warm our brother. It's not heating us, as Mars and the solar plexus would do. It's warming, as the heart would do. And then we can make application to stand before the door. Basically, this is another way of saying we have grasped the hand of our brother. So let's see if there's anything more here for the third one. No, it's basically the first two that deal with this stage. We've made our application to the door, but since we care about our brother, that means, you know, we have grasped his hand and have empathy for him and have united with him and therefore can understand him and therefore care about our brother and will do what we possibly can to improve his or her lot, then we are ready to go through the door. And as a matter of fact, we just are not concerned about the door anymore. It's so often a selfish concern, the usual selfish concern of the applicant to the earlier initiations is gone. Now we just see our brother. Now that I grasp the hand of the brother on the right and on the left. And so it implies the creation of the circle of group life. You know, there are a certain number in a group going through the door, and if we all are meant to grasp each other's hand, then it will complete a circle, and we can go through the door in a circle. But now that we care more about our brother than about our selfish initiatory satisfaction, so to speak, we don't see the door. I seem surrounded by the pilgrims on the way. Again, this takes us, again I stand, the point within a circle and yet myself. Takes us to the second technique of integration. And again, I will point to that because it is related, and I think, and yet myself. It's wonderful about this. Ellis Bailey, CD-ROM. Again, I stand a point within a circle, and yet myself. The love of love must dominate and not the love of being loved. The power to draw unto oneself must dominate. See, that's what happens when we grasp the hand of our brother. But into the worlds of form, that power must one day fail to penetrate. We love our brother not in a formal sense, but in a soul sense. It doesn't mean that we, you know, dislike our brother in a formal sense. It's just not the important thing. This is the first step towards a deeper search. And then, you know, we release ourselves from all that stands around, and basically we have a togetherness achieved. I at a point, at the point, love all. Drawing them to the center and moving forward with the traveling points of light towards the great center, that great center where the one point stands. And we are moving forward together through the door. This is what I wanted to point out. It was surrounded by our fellow human beings, our fellow applicants. We move forward together through the door. I seem surrounded by the pilgrims on the way. And this takes us to the rules of the road, which says the same thing, doesn't it? So let's see if I can find this. Rules of the road. These things are said in so many different ways. And here it is. The road is trodden in the full light of day, thrown upon the path by those who know and lead. It's the masters, the Hierophant, asking these questions. Naught can then be hidden, and at each turn a man must face himself. Now here it is. Upon the road one, well, there's more to it. Upon the road the hidden stands revealed. Each sees and knows the villainy of each, and yet there is with that great revelation no turning back, no spurning of each other. We stay together, right? No shakiness upon the road. The road goes forward into day, and this is the one I was after. Okay. Excuse me, talking a little too fast, right? Well, it's been a few days since I've been able to do this, so I'm kind of eager to get back into it. Upon that road, this is it, one wanders not alone. There is no rush, no hurry, and yet there is no time to lose. Each pilgrim, knowing this, presses his footsteps forward. He thinks he's going alone at first, and finds himself surrounded by his fellow men. Some move ahead, he follows after. Some move behind, he sets the pace. He travels not alone. And even at the end of this marvelous rules of the road, which everybody can say, oh yeah, I know this, and then not do it, he knows he travels not alone. So you see how all of these work together, the catechism and the, all the things that I've mentioned from esoteric psychology and from the rays and the initiations rule. 2 for applicants and esoteric psychology, integration formula number 2, and then the rules of the road, they all emphasize the same thing, we travel not alone. I seem surrounded by the pilgrims on the way, alike they seem. Their note is 1. And that takes us to rule number 9, where it says, let's see if I usually remember it, but let's just be sure. It says, let the disciple merge himself within the circle of the other selves. Let but one color blend them, you see, alike they seem in note, right? Let but one color blend them and their unity appear. Only when the group is known and sensed can energy be wisely emanated. All right, so alike they seem. They're on the same note, right? Alike they seem, their note is 1. It's the note of aspiration, of dedication, of soul response, of unity, all those things. They seem like unto me and press around on every side. I cannot see the door. In other words, this is so important, I drop my selfishness, right? I drop it away, and I, you know, how it is with so many of us, where, oh, when will I, you know, the little I, be initiated, when it is a group response. The ahamkara looms far too large, and we think of ourselves in a limited, isolated way instead of having an identity as a group or as the one. Until we can shift our identity into that which is the group and that which is the one, then we're still under the illusion of separative selfhood, which seeks to go alone through a door. And that is not the truth. Move forward on the path, O pilgrim in the light, and stand together, hand in hand, before the door of light. What seest thou? So, in other words, at first, we have our concern for our brother, and maybe we forget about the door of initiation, but later it seems that as a group we must train ourselves to pass through the door and receive the accolade of fire and be empowered in a way that will help us serve better. So among the true aspirants who are working together hand in hand in mutual cooperation, they press forward and the door again appears. Okay. And wide it seems, not narrow as before. The whole group can pass together, and we are getting involved in the process of group initiation, which will be so important from now on and into the coming age, when groups will be presented to the initiator. I told you, you know, when I went through the Masonic Lodge the first time, I went with 2 other guys. And, we had to share our responses. It was very good training. I mean, you know, it was such that they didn't have a schedule to take only one alone. So bringing several in together taught us a very good lesson about the impending nature of group initiation. The door again appears, and wide it seems, not narrow as before. The whole group can pass through. But what was that I saw before? It was not like the door which now confronts this band of brothers, that's so beautiful, as we stand together on the path. And, you know, we can be on the path. The path is not necessarily wide. It's narrow, and yet there are many of us. We are, in a way, reduced to a point. And we are one being in unity on that path together, one group. Well, and what does the Hierophant answer? The door you saw before was not the real door. It was a figment of your mind. It was how you imagined the door of initiation. It was the door of selfishly intended initiation. Was not real. A thought form of your separative creation, when you thought of you yourself as an isolated personality passing through that door. Only the man who holds his brother's hand can see the door in truth. All right, this is, such a lesson. Sometimes we try to protect ourselves. We're afraid we'll, get some kind of weird vibration from our brother, and we don't want to hold our brother's hand and so forth. And that's just against the laws of occultism. It's just based on separative ignorance. So only the man who holds his brother's hand can see the door in truth, the real door, the wide door, the door that is not wide open to the separative man, but is wide open to the loving, cooperative, mutually progressing group. Only the man surrounded by the many who are the one. This is marvelous, because, we must solve the problem of the one and the many, and the many are the one, and the one is the many. This is something we do maybe on all the rays, but particularly we have to do this on the third ray, which is a ray that tends towards the impression of the reality of multiplicity, and of course it's not real. So we have to resolve that, and then ray 2 and ray 1 are very good in their own ways of resolving into unity and resolving into oneness. Ray 1 finally resolves into complete oneness, ray 2 into unity, which suggests the one. Only the man surrounded by the many who are the one can enter the door which shuts itself upon the man who seeks to enter it alone. What a lesson. And, it's self-explanatory there. Initiation, real initiation, is group initiation, and it is the hierarchy of love, and unless we love, we don't go through. And the loving itself is the going through. According to the intensity of love that we have, so will the various doors open unto us. And you can imagine the Christ standing in the process of the seventh degree, what his degree of love must be, as all these doors have opened unto him, and as so many of the great masters, they bow their knee, on bended knee to him. So that's the catechism. There are others, and we will look at these others. Just when I finished, it said 22, 22. I like that. Two mystical numbers that sum to 44, another one of those magical numbers. There is a numerological key to the secret doctrine. There are many keys, and we have to learn how to turn those keys. We may not turn them all, but once we're through, we will know more about how to turn the other keys, which were not necessarily our path. We have to take the one or two keys which really belong to us and learn how to pass through, and then we can really be of some use, some value. In Lemurian days, initiates entered alone and one by one. There was initiation in Lemurian days. It may be that the first initiation was more what could be taken, but I think even the third was possible. In Atlantean days, the fourth was possible. And now in the Aryan days, the fifth is possible. Although, there were masters in those days of Atlantis, so somehow they achieved. In Lemurian days, initiates entered alone, one by one. The door had to be pretty tall, I guess, because they were pretty large beings. I'm sort of joking there, but when you, my friend Philip told me that the Bahamian Buddhas, those great statues where they in Afghanistan, which were destroyed by the Taliban, were actually the representations of the true stature of early, true physical stature of early man, which HBB hints at. We talk about these Atlanteans, which were about 9 meters tall, maybe in English terms, 27 feet, 28 feet. That's small. That's small compared to some of the size of the Lemurians. Why aren't these skeletons available? Well, we understand that probably there are many reasons, including the earth shifts, but there's something more, that cremation was universally practiced, and so the totality has been destroyed. But we are told, I think somewhere on Astra Moria, that in the caves which the masters supervise, there are these relics which can be brought forth for proof at the right time, and it's going to be in a amazing time. You know, when we read in the Bible, there were giants in those days. We take it as a piece of fabulous writing, fable, myth, but it's going to turn out to be true, and then we're going to have to revise our view of man's history, and then we'll go to the secret doctrine where this is all laid out in an understandable form, and we'll say, aha, here it is. This is an amazing story, and then for those who give credit to it, it will lead right into the ageless wisdom, right to the hierarchy, right to the wisdom stored in Shambhala. It will lead us into the secret doctrine understood in the large and general sense, not in terms of the book, which was, a presentation, a small presentation of the vast secret doctrine. In Atlantean days, Atlantean times, when the door of initiation stood wide open, I guess maybe in the period of 4.5, as my friend Philip would say, the fifth sub-race of the Atlantean root race, the aspirants to mysteries were admitted in groups of seven. Amazing. But had not contacted their fellow group members in physical consciousness. And yet they, together on the causal plane, they stood before the initiator. The emphasis was still, during the training period, upon individual attainment and achievement. So here they thought they were achieving in an individual sense, that their attainment was their own, and parallel to them in other places that they did not contact were others whom they did not contact, and they were achieving similarly, and they all came together on the inner planes. Today, so rapidly is man making spiritual progress, the hierarchy is admitting groups all the time, particularly in connection with those rays which are at present in incarnation. Well, you know, the second ray is certainly among them. The first ray ashram is coming in, the fifth ray, and but as he says, this means that the three major rays, which are always predominantly active, though they may have varying cycles of increased or decreased activity, have large groups undergoing their preparatory training for some one initiation. This group admission will develop rapidly as the world settles back into a cycle of peaceful growth, a cycle, maybe a cycle only, and unfoldment after the drastic experience of the World War. It is for that information, it is for this, that information such as I am here attempting to give must be made available so people will understand the advantages of this peaceful cycle of growth and will not simply settle back into a comfortable sort of materialism. They will, in fact, realize that it's a great opportunity to speed forward, but not alone, holding the hand of our brother. Today, so rapidly is man making spiritual progress, the hierarchy is admitting groups all the time. And I don't know if these are limited by number. In Atlantean days, apparently limited to seven, one by one, seven. And now, what are the groups that are to be admitted? Do they have a number? Here it's not given. rays one, two, well, ray two and five are strongly in incarnation at the moment. Ray six is passing out. Ray three is in incarnation. Ray one, yes, but only in a limited sense. Not too many of the first ray types can be allowed into greater concentration, well, at least not the pure first ray types, as he tells us, whatever pure means. Maybe it's the soul and monad being both on the first ray. Humanity couldn't handle that. Ray four will be coming in, but not really until 2025 and following. And ray 7 will be coming in strongly. But anyway, the three major rays are preparing their groups, and I'm not sure whether, you know, the ray 6 fading out at this point, maybe if they make transition onto the second ray, they can be part of this process. Anyway, so many of us are undergoing preparatory training, we probably don't realize that we are, but all of this work with Master DK and the work to serve and the work to spread the ageless wisdom and the work in psychology and healing and education and whatever of the C group areas we may be attracted to is all part of our preparatory training. So DK is thinking far ahead, and when people want to know, well, look, what's it all for? Because we're passing through a time which I think will lead to nihilism and and relativism, humanism, in the sense that the personality is seen as the God, and the welfare and the comfort of the personality is seen to be the greatest good. And that is just not true. I mean, disciples can tell you it's not true. We don't have to treat the personality badly. It is our good instrument. And for many people who just don't get it yet, you know, we have to serve the personality first and make sure that the personality is in reasonable condition so that the mind can be cultivated and the emotions sensitized and the physical vehicle made more vital. But we cannot fall into an age of comfort. And I'm sure that Saturn as the ruler of the first decanate of Aquarius, and since humanity is the world disciple, humanity will be under that Saturn, even though they usually enter in the opposite way. Saturn will prevent excessive falling into comfort. It can be neither this nor that, as the Buddha said, you know, not the extremes. If there's extreme discomfort, all you do is think about that, and you can't get on with things. If there's extreme comfort, then you are overcome by it, and your aspiration is stifled, and your will remains latent. One other point I would seek to make clear. As you know, an ashram has in it disciples and initiates at all points of evolutionary development and of all grades and degrees. Well, somewhere it tells us that those who are not in the those who have taken the first degree are not really members of the ashram. Well, maybe the probationary initiations are not really members of the ashram, but they certainly stand on the periphery. And as I have pointed out before and will now point out again, if I go here, if I go here, let's say, and well, I'm just going to start at my usual starting point, and then I'll find it where it is. And that's it. Notice, this is the circle of hierarchy. And as I showed you before, that even though you may not be initiate, if you're on the probationary path and have not yet taken initiation, even some probationary disciples here, various grades of disciples before they have taken initiation, are still technically within this circle of the planetary hierarchy. The great circle of Shambhala, which I suppose would be drawn in red, is not drawn. Okay. So we're within that blue circle. We're part of the hierarchy. But technically, to be in an ashram, I mean, the Tibetans group was, in a sense, being invited into his ashram and stood on the periphery of his ashram, but was not, in any sense, intimate to his ashram. It's all a degree of our consciousness that allows that or prevents that. So all grades and degrees, you know, 3, 4, 5, especially 3, 4, 5, and maybe peripherally initiation 2, initiation 1 probably at first, the individuals are not drawn into a group around the ashram. These all work together in perfect unison, yet within their different ranks. For each degree stands alone, yet united with all the others. And that's kind of one of those paradoxes of the occult path, that we are alone with the members of our degree, and we are preparing for similar realizations and stages of unfoldment, and yet we are in very fine, very good cooperation with all the others who are preparing for other things. We really have to learn about that, since there is no separation allowed, or at least no separativeness. There is a kind of a separation between the degrees. There's at least a distinction between that for which the members of various degrees strive and that which they must attain. For each degree stands alone, yet united with all the others, with their own established rapport, their coded telepathic interplay, meaning that we're liable to receive thoughts in common with the members of our degree, but those kinds of thoughts may not enter the mind of those of different, or let's say, of lower degrees. And those of higher degree will have types of thought which will not enter our receiving mechanism. So we are in rapport with all the others, but the coded telepathic interplay tells something about the difference of the kind of thought and energy which is received by the different distinct groups. And a shared occult secrecy and silence which guard the secrets and knowledges of one grade from another and from the unready. Of course, if we are of lower degree, we can speak of these with those of higher degree who have passed through them, but we are not to disrupt the work of those of lower degree by dealing with, thoughts and theories and types of realizations which do not concern them, which they cannot really approach yet, and which would take their mind away from that upon which they should be concentrating. This really requires a great refinement of understanding, to understand the stage of consciousness of one's interlocutor, so to speak, to understand the stage of consciousness without any separative attitude. I mean, you're not going to say, hey, look, I can't talk about these things because you're of lower degree. I mean, you know, that's nonsense. One can't do that. But one has to have that sort of intuitive sense of what is appropriate to speak of with those who have maybe not had as much experience as one has had. And then similarly, that's being done by those above. The Tibetan is doing it all the time, really. Sometimes he's just saying, well, I'm not permitted to speak of these things. I can't speak of these things. You as an aspirant will not understand these things, but you can try, you know. He is careful about what he says to us, and he doesn't bring to us those who are in training for the first three degrees, basically those who's, that's who he's training, doesn't bring to us those kinds of thoughts which are not appropriate to our level of consciousness. Of course, you know, in his books he has written for all degrees, and so if we are alert, we will see what may be written for the fourth degree, or even in some cases for the fifth degree. Not that we will understand them as those who are at the fourth or fifth degrees, or candidates for those. Similarly, when an aspirant seeking upon the physical plane to find those who will share with him the mystery of his next immediate step or demonstrated expansion discovers his own group, he will find that it has in it those who have not reached his particular point of wisdom, and those also who have already left him far behind. And this, you know, this is a hard saying, because we live in these Aquarian days of leveling. You know, as I discussed the tall poppy syndrome of Australia, if one poppy sticks its head up too far, whack, it's decapitated. So everybody should be the same, you know. And that is one of the early misinterpretations of Aquarian vision. Aquarius has to include unity within diversity and hierarchy within the field of commonality. In other words, we're all one being, but there is also a vertical arm. So that does exist, and all through nature we discover the truth of hierarchy. And when we discover it, we have to be careful not to become mentally proud or condescending, and at the same time not jealous or envious. So those are things that have to be rooted out, and we realize we have been there and we will be where others are now. Okay, reading it again. Similarly, when an aspirant seeking upon the physical plane to find those who will share with him the mystery of his next immediate step or demonstrated expansion discovers his own group. Rule 9, and what was that? You know, let the disciple merge himself within the circle of the other cells, but one color blend them, and their unity be seen or be known. Is that it? And their unity appear only when the group is known and sensed. Can energy be wisely emanated? So I'm sure we've all gone looking for our group, and we have sometimes been excited about a group that we may have found, only to discover that that we did not really resonate with it and it with us, or that it seemed to be preparing people for steps too far for us, or steps not far enough for where we stood. So when we find this group with its differentiated strata of achievement, he will be drawn into a vortex of force and a field of service simultaneously. Think about that field of service within the group. Those who have not yet attained what the particular disciple has attained can be served, and those who are ahead will serve those who are behind, but those who are at a certain stage will also cooperate with and serve in a lesser way those who are ahead. So the vortex is a field of service, and of course the vortex can also look out towards humanity, and the whole group can serve humanity in different ways according to those who can modify, qualify, and adapt the plan. Different levels of service given to humanity according to the strata within the group. So he will be drawn into a vortex of force, and can be very challenging, very testing, although there are a lot of glamours about, oh, your life's going to fall apart when you enter this group, but, you know, it might not happen at all, and it might, and then the group thinks of itself as just a little bit exclusive because it can induce a falling apartness in the entering disciple, you know, some distress. So ponder on this statement, and we have just a little done that. He will learn, therefore, the lessons required by one who is to work in an ashram, even though it's a group preliminary to the ashram, and will know how to handle himself with those who may not yet share with him the secrets which he already knows, and with those who have penetrated deeper into the mysteries than he has. You know, I look above, I help below. You know, I look above, I help below. And my hand, in one of the catechisms, is grasping the hand of the brother above me, and his hand grasps mine, and at the same time, I grasp the hand of the brother below me, and his hand grasps mine. So there's this chain of hierarchy, and we are, I don't know how it would go, maybe left hand should be held above and the right hand down. I'm not sure whether that's the way the magician does do it. Maybe it's the other way, actually, but it would make also sense if the left hand or receptive hand were held above, and the hand of will, which can confer a greater power, were held below. But, you know, it can be the other way as well. I have to recheck the magician card, because in a way we will to reach upward, and what we have already established is second nature. It's in our left hand, and we can extend it downward. So both can be considered as working. Okay, well, I think we will go on, even though we have ended a certain phase here. Yeah, let's go on. section 1, the aspirant and the mysteries of initiation. Let us now... Well, you know, I don't know. Maybe all of these should be hour-long programs, but I'll tell you what. I have the notion that this should end, and the next one should begin. So end of Race and Initiation Webinar Commentaries, Program 8, and it is page something to 347, and we probably began at 344. Okay. I just like to keep it clean here if I possibly can. And we'll begin with beginning of Raise and Initiation Webinar Commentary Program 8. This was ending of Program 7, Program 8, and it will be from 347 onward. So basically it's just a 45-minute program, And I hope it finds a place somewhere. But, you know, in case people want to study the Esoteric Catechism all by itself and a little bit of commentary on it, it will stand alone in that sense. So we'll see you before long as we go on to program number 8. Okay, friends, it's a great book, isn't it? You know, and how many of us will read it by ourselves really, really carefully? Maybe we have a class, a study group, we will. But maybe this kind of approach that I'm offering will be an incentive to study this together, or to study it on your own. You know, it's between us. Okay, see you soon. Bye-bye.